Shalom, welcome to ASJTF. This is Chaim Ben Pesach. This program is dedicated to elevating the souls of Simcha Chasdai, Pesach Ben Dov, Bari Hoffman, Ruven Hoffman, Harav Meir Kahana, and Yosef Ben Meir. Before we get to our many questions from our great JTFers, as you know, soon we hope to be putting up our Hebrew and English news sites where we're going to have independent news sites on our web server. In other words, our own news sites on our own web server at our own web address. And if you doubt that there's a need for us to do this, if you doubt that there's a need for us to wake up the Jews of Israel, for instance, look at some of the things that have happened just in the past week in the state of Israel. Number one, Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu promised the Haredim, the religious Jews, that he was going to block new legislation that was being proposed by Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman to basically create easy overnight conversions for non-Jews who want to become Jewish. He promised that he wasn't going to accept this legislation, he was going to stop it. Instead, we now learn that this was another one of his lies and tricks, that Netanyahu, who always lies and who's always a two-faced phony, that he's not going to allow a vote on it in the cabinet, but he's going to allow a vote on it in the Knesset. And if it passes in the Knesset, it becomes law. So what's the difference if it isn't voted on in the cabinet first? It doesn't make a difference. So this is the latest trick of Netanyahu. And why is this important? Because if they change the rules for converting to Judaism, if they allow people to easily convert to Judaism, which is what Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman wants, because he represents hundreds of thousands of Russians who are not Jewish, who came to Israel under false pretenses, and who want to do easy conversions. And by the way, I'm not referring, God forbid, I'm not referring to the wonderful hundreds of thousands of our Jewish brothers and sisters who came to Israel from the Soviet Union. We love the Russian Jews. And if there are Russians who came to Israel whose father is Jewish but the mother's not Jewish, then halachically they're not Jewish, those people can convert. Those people, of course, should be welcomed into the Jewish faith. If they have that type of close connection to the Jewish people where they have a Jewish father but a non-Jewish mother, they're halachically they're non-Jewish. But those people, if they want to convert, absolutely they should be welcomed into the Jewish people, and the conversion process should be made as simple as possible for them without, of course, violating halakha, but it should be made simple for them because they already have a very strong connection to the Jewish people. But I'm not referring to them. I'm referring to Russians who came to Israel and have no connection whatsoever to the Jewish people. None. Who lied and forged papers because the economy in Israel is much stronger than the economy in Russia. So they wanted to get out of Russia, so they figured, oh, Israel's a good place to go. Let me lie and pretend I'm Jewish. I'll get into Israel easily. So Lieberman wants to convert them overnight to Judaism, which would be invalid in the eyes of the Torah, so we would have non-Jews passing as Jews, and it would create a catastrophe for the Jewish people. But the problem goes beyond that. If you allow these easy overnight conversions, millions of black African Muslims who want to get into Israel for economic reasons, and millions of other third world people who want to get into Israel for economic reasons, they're going to claim to be Jewish. They're going to have overnight conversions and claim to have become Jewish, and they're going to be allowed, they're going to have to be admitted under the law of return into Israel as Jews. If this law passes, then all of these third world people, including millions of black African Muslims, will be able to come into Israel under the law of return. God forbid. This is the danger, the catastrophe that we're facing if they change this law. Two-thirds of South Tel Aviv, two-thirds of South Tel Aviv are now illegal aliens from Africa and other third world countries. 61% are black African illegal aliens. 61% of North Tel Aviv's population, according to the Israeli government statistics, 61% of North Tel Aviv's population are black African illegal aliens. And if you add up all of the illegal aliens from third world countries, it's over two-thirds of the population of South Tel Aviv already. They're taking over Israeli cities. And this is in addition to the millions of Arab Muslims who already live in Israel. This is unbelievable insanity, suicidal insanity. And Prime Minister Netanyahu and the Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman and Defense Minister Moshe Yalon, all of them, they all want to betray the Torah, betray the Halakha, betray Judaism, and create this suicidal lunacy that will endanger Israel's very existence. That is one issue that just occurred this past week. A second thing came up this week. India. It was announced that India is planning to buy $500 million worth of missiles from Israel. Israel produced these missiles. Now, generally speaking, Israel is unable to sell weapons to India and other countries. If there's anything, if there's even a screw or a nail or anything that came from the United States in those weapons, Israel cannot sell those weapons to other countries without American permission, and the Americans don't give them permission. So billions and billions of dollars of Israeli arms sales are blocked by President Barack Hussein Ebola and by John Kerry and the other anti-Semites, and past presidents did the same thing. But Barack Hussein Ebola and John Kerry, of course, are doing it even more. But this week, there are missiles that Israel produced entirely in Israel with no help from the United States. Nothing. And so Israel can sell these weapons to India. And India is going to buy $500 million worth of these missiles. Plus, India wants to buy other types of weapon systems, including planes that are produced entirely in Israel. So we're talking about the possibility of Israel selling billions of dollars in weapons to the new government in India. And what a blessing it is that we have this new government in India. We always said, we Kahanists always said, if Israel produces her own weapons entirely in Israel, and if Israel doesn't get U.S. so-called foreign aid, the $3 billion a year that Israel gets from the United States and winds up holding Israel back, and Israel pays 10 times over for that $3 billion in aid. It is so insane. It is so harmful to Israel. If Israel rejects U.S. foreign aid and builds her own weapon systems and becomes independent, Israel will earn billions of dollars a year in weapon sales, technology sales, trade agreements that Israel's being denied right now. Israel will easily make up the $3 billion in foreign aid that the United States gives, way surpass that. Israel will surpass that easily in weapon sales to India and other countries that want Israeli know-how and Israeli brain power. They want that technology. And not only will Israel earn much more, and all of that money will come back to Israel and the Israeli economy instead of sending it to multinational arms manufacturers in the United States, all of that money will come back to the Israeli economy and strengthen Israel's economy. But not only will it be good for Israel's economy, Israel will be independent. Nobody will be able to say, oh, if you don't do what we say, we're going to cut off foreign aid. Israel won't be getting any foreign aid. Israel will be independent and will be able to do what has to be done with her enemies once and for all. And we've always said that there's tremendous potential here, and people said, oh, it's not enough, and what are you talking about, and it's not realistic. It is realistic. Even now, with Israel's crazy policies of dependency and socialism and government bureaucracy and begging President Barack Hussein Ebola and John Kerry every time they sneeze, even with all of this, still India wants $500 million worth of Israeli missiles. Still the potential, we see the tremendous potential there, and India is looking at other weapon systems from Israeli industry. We were right. We were right about Israeli military and economic self-sufficiency, just as we've been right on all of the other issues. If we were in power, it would happen. That's a second issue. Okay, so first we have the conversion, easy overnight conversions to Judaism, which will lead to catastrophe for Israel. And second, we have the issue of how Israel can become independent militarily and economically, if only they had the will. Third issue, another Muslim terrorist attack took place in Jerusalem this past week. A young mother and her three-month-old baby were run over and murdered by a Muslim terrorist. And there are now Arab Muslim riots in support of the Muslim terrorist. He was shot to death after he ran over people. He was finally shot to death. And there are now riots. They're demanding his body. They're making all these other demands. All of them are hailing him as a hero. All the Arab Muslims are calling him a hero. And they're rioting in support of this mass murderer. This guy who murdered a young mother and her three-month-old baby, ran them over and murdered them in cold blood. And the Arab Muslims are saying, this hero, we want his body, he's a hero, and are rioting in his favor. You know what I would do if I were prime minister? I would send out Israeli tanks and run over all the rioters. I'd run over every one of them. I'd tell the soldiers, you run them over, you're going to be court-martialed, every single one of them. I want you to run over every single one of them. That's what I would do if I were prime minister. Everyone picking up, every Arab picking up a stone to throw at a Jewish soldier, I would say, run them over. This is heroism, run them over. Anyway, that's a third thing that happened in Israel this week. And a fourth thing that happened in Israel this week. While all this is happening, while the Arabs are openly calling for a genocide against the Jewish people, they celebrate that a three-month-old Jewish baby was run over and murdered, and they're dancing and celebrating and eating cook candies and going and dancing in the streets. While all of this is happening, the daughter of Hamas Nazi mass murderer, Ismail Haniya, is brought to an Israeli hospital to be treated in an Israeli hospital. The daughter of the Hamas mass murderer is brought to an Israeli, someone who's murdered hundreds of Jewish men, women, and children. His daughter needed some treatment, so she's brought to an Israeli hospital to be treated. How humane, how nice. Chaim ben Pesach, though, is banned from even setting foot in Israel for 19 years already. If you don't feel outraged by everything I've just said now, and if you don't feel like you just want to scream and say, what the hell is going on over here, then something's wrong with you. Then something's wrong with you. Something's very wrong with you, morally, and even in terms of your sanity. God willing, we want to reach the people of Israel with a message of sanity and deal with these issues and wake people up and say to them, this is lunacy. Let's change course here. And I'm telling you, a lot of Israeli Jews are open to our message. You saw 27,000 of them join our Facebook page in just 3 months. 27,000 joined in 3 months. Now, I don't expect those types of results on our independent. We're going to have an independent news page now on hayamin.org, on our own website. We're going to have our own independent news page, and we're going to be updating it daily. We haven't started it yet. Some people have asked me, well, I haven't seen it yet. They've said to me, well, we haven't started it yet. Believe me, we're going to make a big announcement when the time comes. And we're going to do videos promoting it in a big, big campaign. But when we have our own independent news page, I don't expect to get 27,000 people in 3 months. I don't think we're going to get those types of results, because when we did it on Facebook, because it was on Facebook, it was more convenient for people to join and they joined more quickly. We're not going to get those types of results on our independent page, but I do think that we've shown we have the potential to draw thousands of people to our page. And eventually, who knows what that will lead to. That can lead to a very, very important movement and a very, very important source of information for Jews. And I'm hoping eventually that Hebrew news page that will be updated with news stories daily, God willing. I'm hoping that it will lead to thousands and then tens of thousands and huge numbers of people becoming informed and getting news and information and facts from that page that they get nowhere else. And so everything you're hearing in these SJTFs and everything you learn from us, the people of Israel will be exposed to this on a massive level on a regular basis, daily, with daily updates. This would be a dream come true for us. And yes, the stories I told you about and the way we explain it and the way we present it to the people of Israel, a lot of Israelis would like to see our point of view out there. And a lot of Israelis will learn a lot from us. And we will change people. We're not going to change all of them. Some of them are evil. And some of them are just blind and ignorant and refuse to learn and refuse to change, even when confronted with the facts. But there are Israeli Jews who are open to the truth and who are longing for this type of thing. So, just wanted you to know that that's why what we're going to do is so important. And on our English, we plan to also have a parallel English news page. The English news page is not just going to be news from Israel, it's also going to be news from America. And we're going to do a lot of concentration on the 2016 presidential campaign. A lot on the 2016 presidential campaign. As you know, we support Ted Cruz. And we're going to be doing a lot on that anti-Semite, that vicious animal, Hillary Clinton. We're going to be doing a lot on the other evil candidates that are running for the Republican nomination. And I think it'll be, I don't know. I'm looking forward to it. I think all of you are looking forward to it also. I think all of you are looking forward to it also. We're going to need your help. We're going to need good posts. When we have the page, and I'm talking about the English and the Hebrew pages, we're going to need good posts for those of you that don't speak Hebrew, you can help us with the English page. We've got to grow our English movement too. We're going to need good posts. We're going to need you to respond to our articles. Well, you're going to see articles updated, all these articles, videos, other things coming on that page. We're going to need you to respond. We're going to need you to participate and start conversations there about this. And you'll be able to do that, God willing. So we'll need your help on those pages, and we'll need your help publicizing the pages, going to Facebook and YouTube and everywhere else, and Twitter and everywhere else, and publicizing, make people aware and bring them to our pages so that they'll want to come to the page and want to participate and want to join us. We'll need your help. All of everything on those Hebrew and English pages is going to be, you know, we'll go to Google and the search engines. You know, we're going on a program that is very, very friendly toward the search engines. That attracts search engine attention. The more activity we have, the more responses we have, it goes on the search engines. Hopefully it'll bring us more and more traffic. So we'll need your help to get that traffic. And yes, we urgently will need money. We urgently will need money to advertise, to bring the message to as many people as possible so that the advertising will be for the Hebrew page. We're going to need that message to bring the advertising to the Hebrew page so that we can get as many Israeli Jews as possible onto that page and aware of what's going on in Israel as quickly as possible. The English page, we're going to do the advertising for free. We're going to go on Facebook and YouTube and do videos, and you're all going to help us, and we're all going to participate. We're all going to be in one big battle here to try to bring as many people over as possible. And we're going to do that with the Hebrew movement. We're going to do the same thing. We're going to do the free advertising. But in the Hebrew movement, in addition to that, because we face an urgent situation and we want to become a mass movement, in addition to that, we're going to also engage, God willing, we plan to also engage in a campaign of paid advertising. And this time, Facebook and YouTube, they can't take us down because we're not on, when this is not going to, We're going to have pages on Facebook and YouTube. But we'll have our own pages on Facebook and YouTube. But if they take it down, we don't care, because this independent page is going to be our main thing. And the independent page, nobody can take us down. We have the independent page. That's it. They can't censor us. So we're really looking forward to it, and I think you'll agree that the subjects we raise, the matters we raise, are of urgent importance, And also we're going to be talking about Judaism and God and the purpose of life and, I mean, just issues that are so important on the English and on the Hebrew pages. I don't think I have to convince you. I think you, my fellow JTFers, you understand the importance of this. So let's brace ourselves because it's coming soon. Our great admin Shlomo is working hard on it. I know, believe me, I'm frustrated with the fact that it takes time to put up these pages because these are technical, complicated technical issues putting up these pages for us. Believe it or not, we don't have a paid staff. We only have one person on our technical team doing this, that's Shlomo. We don't have, usually the people hire a paid staff of 10 people and each member of the staff specializes in a different area. And we don't have any of that. So it's taking us weeks. It's taking us, I don't know if it's been 6 weeks or what, it's taking us weeks to prepare this, to put it up, to get all the technical things out of the way so that we understand what we're doing and how we're doing it. And it's going to take us a little bit longer. But we're getting there, God willing. God willing. We need your prayers. We need your help. We need you to make the pages look good, and we need you to and we need you to respond on the pages with good posts and advertise the pages as much as possible, and we need your financial help so that we can do paid advertising for the Hebrew page, God willing. All right, I'm really looking forward to it. I think it's exciting, and I'm sure all of you are looking forward to it as well. Okay, let's go now to our questions from our great JTFers. And we start out with the great Wandering Samurai 81, who writes, and I quote, "Should travel to Africa be avoided at all cost?" Unquote. I don't understand why anybody would want to visit that cursed continent. I mean, it's such a disgusting continent. I think everybody on that continent wants to get out of there. And that I understand. Who would want to live in that hideous place? But why would anybody want to go there? Yes, they have beautiful animals there. God has created beautiful wildlife and beautiful animals. And there are jungles there and there are deserts there and there are beautiful sights to be seen there as there are on every continent. God made a beautiful world for us. God loves us and He made a beautiful world for us. And Africa also has many beautiful natural wonders. But you have natural wonders everywhere. Why go to a place filled with murder and disease and filth and squalor? And I mean, dude, why go to a place like that? The people in on that continent make it an ugly place. Without those evil people there, it would be a lovely, beautiful place. But most of the people there, I'm not saying all of them, but the vast majority of residents of that continent are lazy, nasty, murderous people. I don't know if there are 20 or 30 civil wars going on there now where everybody's slaughtering each other and eating each other and cooking each other in pots. You know, if they have pots, that might be too advanced for them. And swinging from trees. I mean, it's a hideous place. I don't know why anybody would want to go there. And now that we have Ebola, and Ebola's not the only thing, you have West Nile virus and all these other viruses and all these other diseases. It's horrible. I don't understand how anybody could want to go there. It's beyond my understanding. And yes, I think it should be avoided. Absolutely. Wandering Samurai now writes, edit from John Savage, Israel's most dangerous enemies are the Zionists, not AIPAC. I don't understand exactly, Wandering Samurai, what you mean here. You mean John Savage made this statement? John Savage, the actor. That he said that the most dangerous enemies of Israel are the Zionists? Zionism means the existence of a Jewish state. So how could Israel's most dangerous enemy be the Zionists? Zionism means the existence of an Israel, the existence of a Jewish state. So the statement doesn't make any sense. And as far as AIPAC is concerned, AIPAC is a very dangerous enemy of Israel. AIPAC are left-wing traitors in the establishment who lobby for things that endanger Israel's survival, including foreign aid, which is bad for Israel. Foreign aid is bad. All foreign aid should be stopped to Israel and to every other country. It's bad. Thank you, Wandering Samurai. I hope I interpreted the last part of your question correctly. And we go now to our great friend Joe Gutfeld, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, why can't you celebrate Halloween? I always thought that the holiday was fun for kids. Thanks, unquote. Because I don't think it's appropriate to say, oh, let's dress up like devils and witches and all these other things. Even though I don't believe in witches and I don't believe in this other stuff. But that's besides the point. The point is it's making it humorous and cute to be evil. In other words, there are no morals. There are no morals in the world. It's cute to be evil. Oh, my little children are dressed up like devils. I don't think that's good. It's also a holiday associated with paganism. And paganism is not, is something Jews are not permitted to associate themselves with. Paganism is idolatry. So, because of the pagan origins of the holiday, and because, again, it's making light of evil, and it's making evil something that's cute and nice and adorable, I don't think that that's good education for children. I think it's bad. I think it's bad for adults too. So I don't think it's a good holiday. Thank you, Joe Gutfeld. And we go now to our great friend Smash Islam, who writes, and I quote, one, Russia and Muslim world used to be more tolerant to fags than West. What switched? Unquote. Well, the Muslim world, there is a lot of homosexuality in the Muslim world. I never knew this until I was in the prison system. And I saw Muslims engaging in homosexual behavior in the prison system. Muslims who eat halal meat and who pray five times a day, and then they're having anal sex. I mean, it was unbelievable. It was so disgusting. It was just unbelievable. I never saw such hypocrisy. You remember their great hero, Yasser Arafat, was a notorious homosexual. Notorious. And of course, he died of AIDS in the end. So the Muslim world, everything is hypocrisy. I see all of these Muslim delis. You know, the Muslims own so many of these little delis. And in a lot of these delis that are Muslim owned, they sell pork. They sell pork. They make you bacon sandwiches in the Muslim delis. You see, you walk by, it says the sign saying bacon in the morning, breakfast, bacon and eggs for breakfast. How can these Muslims be handling bacon? It says in the Quran, according to Islam, if you even touch pork, you're going to hell. If you even touch pork. Now, in Judaism, by the way, we don't have that. Judaism, there's nothing wrong with touching a pig or touching pork. We're not allowed to eat it. We're not allowed to eat it, but just touching it is not, you know, in Islam they made this completely crazy rule that you're not even allowed to touch it. And yet you see all these Muslims selling pork, and you know, you just see them doing things that are so obviously contrary to the Muslim religion. I see Muslims going into liquor stores and buying booze. Muslims are not allowed to drink any liquor at all. So there's a lot of hypocrisy in the Muslim world. It's a hypocritical world. It's a religion that lends itself to hypocrisy and duplicity and phoniness. And so I guess that's probably why you saw this tolerance for homosexuality in the Muslim world, because it's a world of hypocrisy. And has it changed? I mean, I don't know if it's changed. I mean, Iran hangs homosexuals on, you know, they do hang public hangings of homosexuals. So I guess in some countries they're now executing homosexuals. They're doing what Islamic law commands them to do. But still, I think there's an underlying, there always was, and I think there still is an underlying hypocrisy in the Muslim world. Always was and always will be. As far as Russia's concerned, was Russia really more tolerant? I don't know. I know Tchaikovsky was a homosexual. I know that there were homosexuals in Russia. But I don't know if I don't know if that's true. I know that now Putin is taking a stand against it, and it's very popular in Russia. The stand he's taking has been very popular in Russia. As much as I hate Putin, and as much as because he's a KGB communist animal, nevertheless, I wish we had leaders in the West that at least on this issue took the same stand. Smash Islam now writes, two, Oscar Wilde's pilgrimages to Maghreb. Okay, Oscar Wilde again is the author and the poet who was a notorious homosexual. I didn't know, I wasn't aware of the fact that he made visits to Maghreb. Maghreb is in Morocco. I wasn't aware of that. It wouldn't surprise me. I guess you're saying he went to Maghreb to engage in homosexual activity there? I don't know. Wouldn't surprise me. Wouldn't surprise me at all. Smash Islam now writes, three, Lawrence of Arabia. Well, Lawrence of Arabia was a notorious homosexual. And he did engage in homosexual activity. And he, of course, also was fluent in Arabic and spent a lot of time in the Arab world. He was British, 100% British, in terms of his, in terms of being born an Englishman. But he was someone who loved the Arab Muslims. He loved the Muslims and loved the Arabs and would go to the Arab Muslim world and spend time there. Spent a long time there learning, and Turkey also. He learned in Turkey. Was he engaging in homosexual activity there? I don't know. I guess probably. The point being, again, in the Muslim world, there's a tremendous undercurrent of hypocrisy. Everything is hypocritical in the Muslim world. You see their behavior, which is just so hypocritical. They hate women. I mean, the Muslims hate women. Look at this woman in Iran just this past week. Someone tried to rape her, so she killed him in self-defense, and she was hanged. They put her on trial, tortured her, and then she was hanged because she killed a man that was trying to rape her. So, you know, the Muslims, I have never seen such women-hating, such a woman-hating religion. I mean, they treat women, they treat women worse than animals. It's unbelievable. Thank you, Smash Islam. And we go now to the great Lewinsky Stinks, Dr. Brennan Rocks, who writes, and I quote, "Sodomite History Month is almost over. I am so sad. Jews have done nothing but help sodomites, just like they have blacks and Arabs. And like with those other groups, all they get in return is savage hatred. Like blacks and Arabs, sodomites also like to steal other people's history and claim it as their own. Please discuss." Ernst Rahm, okay, we've got a list of four people here, all of whom are homosexual. Ernst Rahm was the head of the SA, the Nazi SA, which had over a million members. And he was one of the leading forces that helped bring Hitler to power. And he was an open homosexual. Everyone in the SA, all the commanders were homosexuals. All of them were homosexuals. And open about it. They were quite open about their homosexuality. And interestingly enough, Ernst Rahm and Hitler were very close. Rahm, for instance, was the only Nazi who called Hitler Adolf. Didn't call him Mein Führer, called him Adolf. The other Nazis all called him, and I'm talking about Nazi leaders, they all called him Mein Führer. And because of that, because they were so close, there were many who believed that Hitler himself was also homosexual. Also, his crazy attitude toward women. There were many who believed that he was also a homosexual. In 1934, it was about a year and a half after Hitler seized power in Germany, after he became the Chancellor and Prime Minister of Germany. In other words, the dictator of Germany. In 1934... Ernst Rahm became too powerful, and Hitler was, and some of the other Nazis were concerned that he may try to seize power himself from Hitler, and so he became a threat to Hitler, and so he was killed. He was killed along with some of the other homosexuals in the Nazi movement who had become very powerful. But the fact is, Hitler it's very, very possible Hitler never would have come to power if not for the support of Ernst Röhm and the other homosexuals who played such a key role in bringing Hitler to power. Okay, so that's, you know, whenever you always have the homosexuals talking about the Holocaust and how homosexuals suffered in the Holocaust. And, you know, the effeminate, the very effeminate homosexuals, the transvestites and the effeminate homosexuals were put in concentration camps. But the homosexuals who were not effeminate, like Ernst Röhm and the Nazis, they were perfectly acceptable. They were considered to be perfect. They were open homosexuals and they were perfectly acceptable and rose to the heights of the Nazi movement. And we see them today. We see leading Nazis are homosexuals. Next is Barney Frank. Barney Frank, and by the way, the reason that the Lewinsky stinks, I think the reason, again, the reason this is being brought up this month is because this month is Sodomite History Month. Barney Frank was a self-hating Jewish congressman, a Jewish anti-Semite, and an open homosexual, openly. He, of course, condemned Israel, of course. What do you expect? And, of course, he abused his position as a congressman. He had a homosexual prostitute living with him who was on probation, who had been arrested numerous times for male prostitution, and was on probation. Using his congressional stationery, Barney Frank wrote letters saying that this male prostitute was gainfully employed and so on and so forth, lying on his congressional stationery, and nothing happened to Barney Frank, even though that's a felony. To use your congressional stationery to lie to federal officials, to federal probation officials, the U.S. Probation Department are federal officials. It's almost like a law, it's almost like, sort of like semi-law enforcement. You're not allowed to submit lying statements to them, and certainly not on federal stationery, using your position as a federal official. That's a felony. All of that's a felony. In fact, there are a number of felonies associated with that behavior. Barney Frank was never prosecuted. Nothing ever happened to him, even though he committed all of these crimes in order to defend this male homosexual who was living in his home. So, another typical example of, you know, they get away with everything. Next on the list is Boy George. Boy George is, again, an open homosexual, a transvestite, and, you know, as usual, an anti-Semite who's made anti-Semitic remarks and who hates the Jewish people. And Boy George, you know, he's the singer, he's a so-called singer. What a disgusting individual. And next is Melissa Etheridge. Melissa Etheridge is an open lesbian. And naturally, she's a, you know, she raises money and supports and campaigns for Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, Barack Hussein, Ebola, all the usual suspects. She's an untalented singer. When she said she's a lesbian, of course, her career took off. You know, all of a sudden, Hollywood and the media started promoting her like crazy. Well, as soon as she said she was a lesbian, you know, just like Ellen DeGeneres. You know, when they say they're lesbians or they're homosexuals, then the media feels the media has to promote them. She's an untalented piece of garbage and a pervert. And she everything she promotes in her hideous life is evil. Anyway, thank you, Lewinsky Stinks. Hopefully that will give us a little bit of an insight into some of the other stars in this month that is I don't know what they call it, Gay Pride Month. I don't know what they're calling it, but you have it right, the Lewinsky Stinks, when you say it's Sodomite History Month. Thank you, Lewinsky Stinks. And we go now to our great friend Binyamin Yisrael, who writes, and I quote, one, you talked about the seas of Israel but omitted Eilat. What do you think of Israel's Red Sea coast in Eilat? Unquote. It's beautiful. It's a beautiful resort. It's not my favorite part of Israel because it's a resort with hotels and tourists and, you know, there's sinful behavior goes on there and so on and so forth and all types of things. I mean, it's notorious for that. There's a lot of prostitution in Eilat. So there are things there that I'm not really thrilled with. Physically, it's beautiful. Physically, it's, you know, like the whole land of Israel is physically beautiful. It's just such a beautiful country. Benjamin now writes, too, do you have an affirmative action story from Grand Central Terminal, unquote? I can't think of one right now. Affirmative action story from Grand Central Terminal. I really can't think of one. I can't think of one, and I've been there quite a few times because I used to travel. I used to travel from there, especially when I went upstate or when I went to Westchester and Rockland, and you know, I had to travel to those places when I was running the JDL. I can't think of an affirmative action story from there, to tell you the truth. I'm sorry, Benjamin. Thank you, Benjamin. And we go now to our great friend Chicago Jew, who said, and I quote, I'm surprised that you said you never encountered neo-Nazis outside prison. Weren't you in Skokie almost 40 years ago protesting against them, unquote? Yes, I was in Skokie. But the neo-Nazis who threatened to march in Skokie never marched. We never got to see them. They chickened out. They said they were going to march. They said they were going to march through Skokie, which was a town at that time with thousands of Jewish survivors of the Nazi concentration camps. So they were deliberately going to march through that town as a provocation to the Jewish concentration camp survivors. But they chickened out. Our great leader, Rabbi Meir Kahana, Zatzal, and the JDL, we went out there, and Rabbi Kahana said openly that if you go into that town, you're not going to get out alive. And they said to him, what are you threatening? He said, I'm just saying as a fact, their legs are going to be broken. Their legs are going to be broken, and we'll see if they get out alive. That's what Rabbi Kahana said. And they chickened out. The head of the Nazi group, I don't even remember his name now, Collins, I think, Frank Collins, the head of the Nazi group there that wanted to organize the march, he was later arrested for molesting little boys and for child pornography and for pedophilia. So, I mean, we were talking about Ernst Röhm and the open homosexuals in the Nazi movement. This is an example. He was the head of the Nazi party there. He was the head of the Nazi party, but he was the head of a big Nazi group that had national attention and was on national television discussing his Nazi views. And then, you know, then he's arrested for child pornography and for child pedophilia charges against little boys. I mean, what sick people. Anyway, Chicago Jew, so I didn't actually get to see the Nazis because they chickened out. They never showed up. Thank you, Chicago Jew. And we go now to the great Nachus, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, being that Hashem gave the land of Israel to the Jewish people, when will certain parts of it stop being referred to as settlements, quote unquote? Okay, great question. well, you know, I don't care about the word settlements because I don't think there's anything wrong with Jews settling their land. What's wrong with Jews settling in their land? I mean, I don't have a tremendous problem with it. I know that people use the word in a derogatory sense to say you're settling there. That means it's not your land. You're taking someone else's land, which of course is just baloney. It's just a complete lie. The entire land of Israel was given to the Jewish people as an eternal as part of an eternal covenant, forever and ever, the Jewish people are the owners of the land of Israel. The Arab Muslims have no right to any part of the land of Israel. They have no right to be in the land of Israel. And everything they have there is stolen. It's like stolen property. They're trespassing in the land. And their goal is to exterminate the Jewish people and commit genocide. Until the Messiah comes, you're going to have anti-Semitism in the world, and the world will be against Israel. That's just the way it is. Most of the world will hate the Jews and hate Israel until Melech HaMashiach, until the Messiah, the King of Israel comes. Until that happens, the world is going to be against Israel, and they're going to refer to whatever they want to refer to in order to stop us from redeeming our land. It's important, of course, for us to remember, though, for Jews and for righteous Gentiles to always remember that God is the one who decides who is the owner of what, and the land of Israel was always given to the Jewish people and was always the inheritance of the Jewish people. And the Arab Muslims, by the way, they came after the Jews, even in the 20th century. There is no Palestine, there are no Palestinians. The Arab Muslims who came to Israel, mostly from Egypt, came after the Jews started cultivating the land 120 years ago. When they saw the Jews were doing that, they saw employment opportunities and other opportunities there. So the vast majority of them who are there now, they came after the Jews came. Only after the Jews came in order to try to find work and find economic opportunity there. And they were encouraged by the British to come there also in order to prevent the creation of a Jewish state. But there was never a Palestine or a Palestinian people in that land. That land belongs to the Jews. Thank you, Nachus. And we go now to our new friend, Righteous Indian Gentile, who writes, and I quote, please comment, Michael Schweier. I apologize, Righteous Indian Gentile, but I don't know who that is. I do not know who Michael Schweier is. Ehud Barak was the Prime Minister of Israel, the Defense Minister of Israel, Chief of Staff, a terrible left-wing, self-hating Jew who offered to give the Arab Hitler Yasser Arafat 97% of Judea and Samaria, half of Jerusalem, offered to retreat from virtually the entire Golan Heights in negotiations with Syria, was ready to give up everything when he was Prime Minister. And miraculously, thank God, Arafat was dumb enough to turn him down. And Assad, who was the dictator of Syria, was dumb enough to turn him down. I mean, it was a miracle. It was just a miracle from God that God hardened the hearts of our enemies and prevented this terrible disaster from taking place, because it would have been national suicide for Israel. And next is Ehud Olmert on the list. Ehud Olmert also was a prime minister of Israel, another self-hating traitor who's on his way to jail now, who's going to be spending years in prison now for bribery and corruption. And this was the dirtiest, most corrupt and evil person in politics. Just scum, pure scum. He also offered to give the whole land back that was never theirs to begin with. He also offered to give the whole land over to the Arab terrorists. They turned him down too. Miraculous. I mean, it's miraculous that this is one of the greatest miracles. There are many, many unbelievable miracles. So many miracles, countless miracles that have accompanied the return of the Jews to their land. But one of the miracles is God has created an Arab enemy that many times is even dumber than the Jews. The Jews are brilliant, brilliant geniuses in science, technology, art, literature, entertainment, music. You name the subject. Unbelievable geniuses. In every area, they excel way out of proportion to their numbers. But in one area, survival, they are the dumbest people you can ever meet. Unbelievably stupid when it comes to their own survival. Yet God miraculously saves them. Despite themselves, God saves them over and over again. And one of the things he does is he actually miraculously creates Arabs, the Arabs who surround them and want to destroy them, he creates Arabs who do things that are even dumber than what the Jews themselves do. And that's a true miracle. I mean, the Jews offer them 97%. They say, what do you mean 97%? It should be 100%. You know, I mean, just insane, just insanity. Some of the things the Arabs have turned down that have saved the Jewish people. It's just a miracle. Righteous Indian Gentile now asks about Jeffrey Jacob. I'm not sure who that is. Righteous Indian Gentile. Jeffrey Jacob. I don't know who that is. And Righteous Indian Gentile writes, also the idea of Nile to the Euphrates, unquote. Nile to the Euphrates are the borders of the land of Israel, according to according to many of the rabbinic commentators. There are other rabbinic commentators who say that it's that the border is somewhat different. It's all about the same size, but some of them put the border a little more to the west and a little less to the east. Others put it more to the east and less to the west, because it depends on what you mean when you say the great river in Egypt. It says in the Torah, what is the great river in Egypt? The Nile, or is it the Wadi El Arish in the Sinai? So, whether or not it's the Nile to the Euphrates, or whether it's not, or whether it's from Wadi El Arish in the Sinai, there's no question that the land of Israel is much, much greater than the land than the puny little country that the Jews have now. Someday that land will all belong to the Jewish people. That will all be part of the land of Israel someday. Thank you, righteous Indian Gentile. And we go now to our good friend DGR81, who writes, and I quote, "Hello, Chaim. Do Jews still sacrifice 72 bulls?" Unquote. And then there's another question which we'll get to in a moment. No, the 70 bulls that the Jews sacrificed on the holiday of Sukkot was only when we had Beit HaMikdash, the Holy Temple. We don't do animal sacrifices anymore when we don't have the Holy Temple. The Holy Temple, Beit HaMikdash, has to be rebuilt for us to do animal sacrifices again. Beit HaMikdash HaShlishi, the third Holy Temple, is going to be rebuilt. It should only happen speedily in our day. Amen. It's going to be rebuilt, and this time it will be forever. This one will never be destroyed, this third one. But as long as we don't have the Holy Temple, we can't do animal sacrifices anymore. The 70 bulls were sacrificed on behalf of the 70 Gentile nations in the world for the well-being of the righteous Gentiles who live in the 70 Gentile nations. Not for the evil anti-Semites, but for those righteous Gentiles in each of the 70 nations, for their prosperity and for their good, for their well-being. 70 bulls were sacrificed on their behalf every Sukkot, on the holiday of Sukkot, which is the Feast of the Tabernacles, which we just celebrated. DGR now writes, "What is the point of animal sacrifice in Judaism?" Unquote. Well, we have what we call a machloket, a difference of opinion here among Chazal. Chazal are the rabbinic sages. But I'm going to go by what Harambam, Maimonides, tells us, and there many rabbinic sages do not agree with him. But still, he is a great rabbinic sage, and his point is certainly valid. Animal sacrifices, which are called korbanot is how we say sacrifices in Hebrew. The korbanot, according to Harambam, which is one of the traditional rabbinic opinions, is because all nations at the time engage in animal sacrifice. Now, they were sacrificing to idols. All nations did this. This was the form of worship in those days. Just like today, you see people going and praying and doing various other types of worship. In those days, everybody did animal sacrifices. That was how they worshipped their gods. And so God agreed, according to Maimonides, according to Harambam, in Hebrew we call him Harambam, according to Harambam, God agreed to take this practice of animal sacrifice and elevate it to holiness. In other words, a practice that was, and by the way, there are rabbinic sages who disagree with this point of view, but I'm just giving you just one of the possible points of view that exist from a great rabbinic sage. What God did is he elevated a practice that was universal at that time, that was universal for many, many years, for thousands of years, it was universal. And he elevated it to holiness. And so he agreed to take the practice and elevate it to holiness. This is not the only time we see this. We see, for instance, in the code of Hammurabi, that it says an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, and so things that it also says in the Bible. God is willing to take human determinations and human decisions and human judgments, if he feels that they're righteous or logical, God will accept what human beings decide and will elevate them. But he'll elevate them to holiness under his rules. So, for instance, an eye for an eye under the code of Hammurabi was literally an eye for an eye. They literally would, if you accidentally caused, in an accident, you caused somebody to lose their eye, they would literally poke your eye out. I mean, this was the law of Hammurabi. In Judaism, it doesn't literally mean that. In Judaism, it means that if you accidentally poke someone's eye out, that you must pay. You must pay the cost. You've got to compensate them financially for the cost of the loss of that eye, or the loss of their tooth, or the loss of a hand, or whatever. And again, we're assuming that this was accidental. If you do something like this accidentally, then you've got to pay for the cost. Now, under the laws that existed before then, people literally were paying. So a rule or a law that was that existed among the nations, that existed among humanity, was taken by God, and he said, okay, we'll use this rule, but we're going to do it according to my way. My way is you don't literally poke somebody's eye out. You don't literally do that. You pay their financial cost, and you've got to compensate them. Yet the Torah leaves the language in of an eye for an eye or a tooth for a tooth in order to make sure that people understand the gravity of this. It says if you should get your eye poked out, you should be very careful next time. And remember how precious it is when a human being loses their eye. It's as if you should get your eye poked out or your tooth removed. If someone loses their tooth because of this, because of you, because of your carelessness or because of an accident or whatever, you should remember how precious it is. So think of it as if you're losing your eye or as if you're losing your tooth, even though you're only going to pay compensation here. I hope that's clear. But so the point is that God takes rules that human beings create sometimes and elevates them and accepts them and elevates them to holiness. That's something that does happen sometimes. God will accept certain things that people decide to do, and the Creator accepts that because He wants us to be His partners. We're His servants, and we're His partners, and we're His partners in correcting the world. Tikkun Olam, it's called, correction of the world. And so animal sacrifice was universal. It was done by all the nations of the world, so God decided to elevate it to holiness. If you're going to have animal sacrifices anyway, God was saying, in effect, do it first of all for the real God, not for idols, God forbid, and do it only under the supervision of the Kohanim, of the priests at the Holy Temple, where I have chosen for this to be done. Do it the proper way, under my rules and under my laws and under my mitzvot, under my commandments. If you're going to do it anyway, okay, I'll accept that you're going to have this practice, but I want you to do it my way, the way I command you to do it. Now, you may say, but what's the relevance to this today? Most people don't have animal sacrifice today. But most people today do eat animals. Most people eat beef and eat other animals. So God, even today, God is in effect saying, if you're going to eat animals anyway, if you're going to slaughter animals anyway for purposes of consuming them, at least elevate this practice to holiness. Why not elevate it to holiness and use it for a purpose? And so when people went to do animal sacrifices and went to the Holy Temple, they had prophetic experiences. Many people had prophetic experiences. They had uplifting experiences and spiritual happiness and joy that they had never seen in their lives, that are beyond anything we can imagine. Just incredible things occurred at the Holy Temple. I mean, I could go through a whole list of things that happened that were really just incredible at the Holy Temple. And so God takes a practice and makes it sacred. You want to eat a hamburger? Instead of just going and eating hamburgers or just going and slaughtering animals so you can eat them, you give a portion of it to the priests, and you show your devotion to God and you show your devotion to Judaism and to the Torah, and you make a pilgrimage to the holiest site in the world. In other words, you turn the pleasure that you would have from consuming an animal, you turn this pleasure into something that also will uplift you spiritually. That's the purpose. Thank you, DGR. There's also a debate, by the way, among rabbis if this will continue, if the practice will go on forever. Harambam, Maimonides, believes that we'll always have animal sacrifice forever. There are others like Harav Kook who believe that the time would come when eventually we would probably be eating other things other than animals, and we'll probably become vegetarian again. So there are all types of opinions on what eventually will happen. There are different opinions among rabbinic sages about what eventually will happen in terms of this, whether humanity will rise to a point where we won't want to kill animals or eat animals anymore. That's a possibility as well. But right now, when the vast majority of the world does eat animals, at least let's elevate what we're doing to something that will give us a spiritual meaning. Thank you, DGR, and we go now to the great Kalman Ben Menachem, who writes, and I quote, Reb Chaim, if JTF posts its Hebrew videos online directly, can't the Israeli government block access from Israel to the JTF Hebrew site? Thank you, unquote. Oh, we're going to be posting our Hebrew videos on YouTube. We're going to continue to post them on YouTube. We're going to continue to post the Hebrew and the English videos on YouTube. We're just going to put links on our main page to the videos. But the videos will be on YouTube. And as far as the Israeli government blocking access to the Hebrew site, they haven't done anything like that. The Israeli government has not been doing that type of thing to anybody. And I don't anticipate that they're going to be doing that. It would be very difficult for them to do that. I don't anticipate it. And our Hebrew movement, Kalman, our Hebrew movement is legal in Israel. Our movement's not outlawed in Israel. So, you know, I don't anticipate that being a problem. I don't think that's going to happen. They have not done that ever. As far as I do not know of any instance where the Israeli government has blocked access to any site, including to sites of Arab terrorists and Muslim terrorists. I have not seen them block any access on the internet. It's very hard to block access on the internet to sites. It causes all types of It creates all types of issues. I know that there are dictatorial governments that have tried to do it with very limited success, by the way. China has tried to do it, in Iran and so on. But their success is limited. It's not easy to completely block access to a site. But I don't anticipate that the Israeli government is going to be doing this. I do not think they're going to be. They have never done this to any site. I don't think that they're going to do it to our site. And our videos will continue to air on YouTube and elsewhere, regardless. Thank you, Kalman. And we go now to the great Tag Mechir Tzedek, who writes, and I quote, was Noah's Ark episode literal or allegorical in your opinion, unquote? I believe it was literal. I believe there was a flood. And I believe there was a Noach. The question is, was the whole world flooded? Every single creature, every animal, all of humanity destroyed, and then we all started again from just 8 human beings in the ark, in Noah's ark. That's the question. In my opinion, I have serious doubts that the entire world was flooded. But we do have historical record that there was a very serious flood. And it's something that is recorded in numerous civilizations, numerous countries speak about that there was a terrible flood that took place. In different languages, different civilizations, thousands of miles away, people do speak about a very serious flood. So I do believe there was a very severe flood that took place. Whether or not every single person, every single animal and creature on the world was destroyed by it, that I have doubts about. Not because I doubt that God can do it. God can do anything. God can destroy the world in a millisecond. God can do anything he wants to do. But the question is, would he want to do that? That's the question. Would he want to do something like that? I do believe that there was a serious flood. The only question I have is whether it actually destroyed absolutely everything, whether that should be taken literally. And I do believe certainly that the Torah account, the biblical Torah account of why it took place because of the evil of human beings, I believe that is also true. So I think the story is true. My only question is whether the entire world was completely flooded down to the last person. That I have a question about. You have things in the Torah, for instance, that says, I'll bless you for 1,000 generations. 1,000 generations, and sometimes it says for 10 generations. 1,000 generations means forever. Chazal tell us that. It's not literally 1,000 generations. That means forever. So there are times in the Torah when it says the whole world is going to do something. Sometimes there's a purpose in saying that we're supposed to be understanding. But we have to know when to separate that in a literal sense and an allegorical sense. And now Tag Mechir Tzedek writes, and I quote, two, Ebola, are blacks naturally cursed, unquote. Black people come from Ham, who was one of the three sons of Noach. And Ham was cursed. Well, actually, Canaan was cursed. Canaan came from Ham. But it started with the behavior of Ham. Ham ben Noach. Because he saw his father's nakedness and he humiliated and ridiculed his father. And so there is a curse there. Now, does that mean that black people, that every individual black is always going to be cursed in their life? Of course not. Even if there's a curse on somebody or on a people, that can be canceled if people become righteous, if people change their ways. Curses can be canceled. If people change their ways and become righteous and turn to God, curses can be canceled. That's the whole story of Jonah. Curses can be canceled. Plans to destroy nations can be canceled when people repent and change their ways. So if there are black people who decide to live righteous lives, they're not under any curse. But if they decide to be evil, of course there's going to be a curse. Anyone who lives an evil life is going to be cursed in the end. Ebola is, like the other diseases, is a result of the slop and the filth that exists in Africa. They live disgusting lives. Where they, the food they eat and the lack of sanitary conditions and the laziness and eating mosquitoes and flies and insects and just the disgusting behavior and eating animals live and being too lazy to even cook them. I mean, just this disgusting behavior is just, it leads to all types of terrible diseases. And I think Ebola and West Nile virus and AIDS are all a reflection of that. They all come from Africa. Thank you, Tag Mechir Tzedek. And we go now to the great Dr. Dan, the voice of reason, common sense, and logic, who writes, and I quote, one, who is the bigger hero, Yonatan or King David? They were both great, great heroes. I don't want to say who was bigger than the other one for one reason, because that's like putting down the second one. Even indirectly, I don't want to put, because they're both so great, I don't want to even indirectly seemingly put one down, you know what I mean. Because they're both such great figures in Judaism, Yonatan and David HaMelech. David HaMelech is King David. Of course, the Messiah is going to come from King David. So probably King David is put on the very highest level, together with Moshe Rabbeinu and the fathers of the Jewish people, Abraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, they're put on the very highest level. And King David was definitely the greatest king in Israel's history. So in that respect, maybe you can say that one is higher than the other, but I don't want that to be interpreted, God forbid, as putting Yonatan down. Yonatan was a great hero for the Jewish people. You know, Yonatan was supposed to be the successor to his father, Shaul. Shaul HaMelech, King Shaul. And he gave up that and was loyal to King David. He was loyal to King David. His father wanted his son, Yonatan, to become the king, to follow him and succeed him. Yonatan didn't want it because Yonatan saw that King David was more worthy of becoming king. And so Yonatan gave up his power to become king of the Jewish people. And it was a big, powerful, wealthy empire at that time. He gave all of that up because he saw that for the good of the Jewish people, for the good of the world, and for the sake of truth and righteousness, that David should be the king. So, I mean, how many politicians would do that nowadays? Would say, oh no, you know what? This guy is more qualified, is better than me. I'll step aside for him. When the person is right next in line and is about to succeed, I mean, how many politicians would do that? Yonatan, nowadays at least, nobody would do that. Yonatan was an extremely righteous and magnificent person. It's like Moshe Rabbeinu and Aharon, Moses and Aaron. Aaron was Moses' older brother. So Aaron should have been the one to take the Jews out of Israel. And Aaron was a better speaker than Moses, because Moses had problems speaking. Aaron was a better speaker, and Aaron was older than Moses, and Aaron was the leader of the Jewish people during all the time. He knew the Jews and understood them better, because Moses grew up with Pharaoh, in the house of Pharaoh, whereas Aaron grew up with the Jews and was in effect the leader of the Jews. So Aaron could have said, hey, what is this? He's my younger brother. He's been with the Jews less than me. He doesn't speak as well as me. What is this? Why is he being chosen? This doesn't make sense. No way. God said that Moshe Rabbeinu should be chosen, and Moses himself didn't want to accept the leadership because he was afraid he was going to hurt his older brother Aaron for 7 days. When God spoke to him through the burning bush, for 7 days, God had to persuade Moses to finally accept it. Moses was finally saying, no, I'm not qualified, and so on and so forth. Finally, God said to him, and your brother Aaron is on his way to meet you and is happy to meet you. In other words, is happy that you're going to be the leader. That's when Moses finally accepted it after 7 days. But Aaron gladly stepped aside for his younger brother, who didn't speak as well as him. But God felt his younger brother was more worthy to be the leader. The same thing with Yonatan. He stepped aside for King David because he saw that God believed that King David was more worthy to be the leader. That is greatness. A Jew that's willing to step aside and willing to put ego aside for the good of the Jewish people, for the good of the world, for the sake of justice and truth and righteousness. Those were great Jews. Dr. Dan now writes, and I quote, too, how did the rabbis decide what was allegory and literal in the Torah, such as the 10 plagues? Well, first of all, the rabbis have the Midrash, the Mishnah. They have the Mishnah, which is the oral law, Torah she'be'al peh, the oral law, which was given to us at the same time as the written law. So the rabbis actually know, in many cases, what is literal, what is allegory, they know from our traditions, from our long history and our traditions, they know what actually happened and what is allegory. Sometimes there are differences of opinion among the rabbis as to what is allegory and what is literal in the Torah. Sometimes there are. There's what we call a machloket, a difference of opinion. But there are ways of knowing. The 10 plagues certainly were not allegory. The 10 plagues were literal. There literally were 10 plagues. And no one is more of a rationalist than me. Okay, I am the ultimate rationalist. You hear my answers on these shows. You know that I'm a rationalist. And you know that I'm more in the camp of Harambam, of Maimonides, who was also a rationalist. But there were certainly real miracles that did occur, and the 10 plagues was a miracle that did occur, just like the parting of the Red Sea was a miracle that did occur. I mean, there were real miracles. There certainly were real miracles that did occur. That there's no question. There's no dispute. No rabbi will say, none of the rabbinic sages will say the 10 plagues or the parting of the Red Sea was allegorical. That certainly was. Those certainly were real miracles that did occur. God used nature, and in some cases even changed the rules of nature temporarily, in order to show that he was the king of the world and ruling over the world. Thank you, Dr. Dan. And we go now to our great friend, the Machnik, who writes, and I quote, many atheists, agnostics, liberals say the Bible is full of violence. How do you respond to those allegations? Does the Torah preach peace? Unquote. Of course the Torah preaches peace, but not toward evil people that want to exterminate us. The Bible is a moral book, and a moral book would not say, let's have peace with Nazis. Let's have peace with Muslim Nazis, for instance, that want to push us into the sea. Let's have peace with the Canaanites who want to exterminate us and who throw their babies into the fire as a sacrifice to their gods. Let's have peace with the Amalekites, who are also the Nazis of their day and want to exterminate us and who are just pure evil. The Torah is not in favor of tolerating evil. The Torah wants truth and justice. The Bible is full of violence, yes, because the world is full of violence. The Bible is a book of truth. We can't pretend and live in a fantasy world on an island, act like we all live on some isolated island and we don't live in the real world. The real world is full of terrible, horrible violence. Dozens and dozens of senseless wars are taking place all over the world right now as we speak. The Bible addresses that issue. The Bible does not pretend that the answer to such evil is to wave a magic wand and have a sign saying peace now. That's not the answer. That will only bring more violence and more tragedy and more evil, and we see repeatedly throughout history that that's what happens. But when we follow the biblical course of how to deal with evil, that is the true road to peace. Evil, we can't coexist with evil. We have to defeat evil. And we have to defend the righteous. And defend the truly merciful and kind people in the world. The merciful and kind and loving and compassionate people in the world we have to defend. The evil, monstrous people that want to destroy them should have done unto them what they want to do to the righteous. That's justice. That's righteousness. That's truth. And the Bible represents truth and justice and righteousness. And that is the only road to peace. Thank you, Imachnik. And we go now to, let me just check something for a moment here. Okay. And we go now to the great Mansch, who writes, and I quote, after a murder of a three-month-old baby, Arabs should have been tremoring and hiding in their holes. Instead, the next day, they attack a Jewish kindergarten. Clearly, there is no deterrence, unquote. Of course, absolutely, Mansch, you're 100% right. It's so obscene. Mansch, a lot of people can say a lot of things about what would happen if we were in the Israeli government, if we were running things in Israel. But one thing is for sure, the Arabs would be terrified of us. That there would be. There would be deterrence, and the Arabs would be terrified of us. That you could bet your life on. And that means that three-month-old Jewish babies would not be run over and murdered in the middle of a street. And their mother, the mother of this three-month-old baby, also died today as we're doing this program. The mother is dead and the three-month-old baby dead, murdered. That wouldn't be happening in the middle of Jerusalem if we were in power. Because those beasts who carry out those crimes would not be living in the land of Israel if we were in power. So, whatever, you know... If we want to protect the Jews of Israel, if we want to protect the good people and the righteous people, the people that we should love and care about, which are our fellow Jews, if we want to protect them, there is no way to protect them. as long as we have millions of people who want to murder them living in the land of Israel. There is no way to protect them or shield them under those circumstances. They've got to go, either they go or we go. It's going to be one or the other. And we don't intend to leave. Anyway, thank you, Mensch. Great point. And we go now to our great friend Papercut, who writes, and I quote, Chaim, Halloween should be about Vlad the Impaler. He and his army killed off thousands of Muslims. Dracula was a hero, unquote. Papercut, I have to plead ignorance. I don't know enough about Vlad the Impaler. Vlad the Impaler was also Dracula, by the way. Now, I know when people hear this, they're going to think, Dracula, what, isn't that a vampire? And all the stories of the vampires. The story of Dracula that people are familiar with, the legend of Dracula, was written by somebody about 115 or 120 years ago. So, and it was based upon the stories that were told about what Vlad the Impaler did to his enemies. Vlad the Impaler, who was ruling over parts of Romania and Transylvania, what is today Romania, he was rebelling. He was fighting against the Turkish Muslim invaders and the other Muslim invaders. That is very true. Was he a righteous person? I don't know enough about him. I don't know enough about him. Obviously, the battle against the Islamic invaders is a just battle. But I don't know enough about him to comment. I'm going to have to plead ignorance, but it's certainly food for thought. It's something to think about. There's no question that he killed a lot of Muslims and that he did rebel against the Muslims. He rebelled against the Muslim invaders. That is certainly true. That is certainly a point well taken and it's something to think about before we say bad things about Dracula based upon some book that was written that is not historical fact. Thank you, Papercut. And we go now to a new person on our forum, PMN, who writes, and I quote, do you want secular atheist Jews in Israel? Can a true Torah Israel remain competitive without the many secular Jews in science and business who might leave, unquote? Okay, that's a great question. I don't believe they would. First of all, I don't believe that most of the secular Jews would leave. I think most of the secular Jews would remain because the economy in Israel will be booming and the technology sector will be booming because we're going to drastically reduce taxes. We're going to create a new competitive edge in a free market economy in Israel, and that plus Jewish brain power will make Israel an economic powerhouse. Israel's already a technological powerhouse, but we can turn Israel into a technological powerhouse far greater, far, far greater than what we see today, much greater. If we just remove the socialist bureaucracy and the very high taxes and the oppressive government intervention that we see in Israel today, if we got that out of the way, Jewish brains can create unbelievable miracles in Israel. First of all, let me just say a number of things. There are many secular Jews in science and business. There are also, by the way, many religious nationalist Jews now in science and business. All religious Jews are not Hasidim who live in Mea She'arim. You have a lot of religious Jews, what they call the Knitted Kippah Jews, who serve in the Israeli army, who live in Judea and Samaria, who are involved in science and technology in the university world, in the business world, and they're religious Jews. So many of the people in Israel's science and technology and business sectors are religious as well, just so that you'll know. A Torah true Israel, first of all, would be gradually created. Secondly, I believe that many secular Jews would become religious if they were offered a Jewish education. If they and their children suddenly saw how beautiful Judaism is and were given a Jewish education, I think many of them would become religious. The ones who would leave, and there's no question that that huge numbers of left-wing Jews would leave. I think a lot of leftists would leave. I think a lot of homosexuals in North Tel Aviv would leave. the peace now type people, a lot of the militant atheists and the anti-religious people, yes, they would leave. I think that they are a liability to Israel in every respect. And I think that they are a terrible liability to Israel. And I think that whatever we would lose from them in science or business, in the science or business sectors, by not having their socialist ideology and their self-hating ways and their demoralizing behavior and their amoral filth, without having that in Israel, we would gain far more than we would lose. I want them to leave. The left-wing atheist, immoral, real haters of religion, the type of the left-wing haters, who I do think would leave if we were in power, they are a terrible liability to Israel and to any other country. I pity the country that they go to. I pity the country that they go to. They are not an asset to any country. If they, even if they have science and business and other technology and whatever they have, they use that to, and then demand that the country turn over all of that to their enemies. They use everything that they create is for the benefit of their enemies. They are the sickest people. They're the enemy from within. It is not good for Israel to have an enemy from within. We will have more than enough brilliant Jews in science and in business and in every other area that currently are not even involved in science and in business, because it's the taxation policies and the education crazy education system and the bureaucracy and all the other things that hinder people, that block people, and the lack of competition and a free market. When we change all of that, you're going to see huge numbers of Jews, brilliant, talented, unbelievably brilliant and talented Jews, entering into science and entering into technology and entering into the business world and creating all new types of opportunities and possibilities that will be way beyond the few hundred thousand left-wing, self-hating, anti-religious Jews that I'm sure will want to run out of Israel and probably move to Berlin or wherever they'll move. They'll probably move to Berlin, which is appropriate. You know, good riddance. We want Jews who are loyal to Israel and loyal to the Jewish people and who are not Jewish anti-Semites. We don't want an enemy from within. And we will create a healthy, prosperous, great Israel. And it will be an Israel that believes. And it'll be an Israel where families have lots of children and reproduce and have a big population growth and create the healthy world, the healthy Jewish family unit that will be a light unto the nations and a holy nation and a nation of priests. Thank you, PMN. And we go now to our great friend, Russian Leo 777, who writes, "Why did so many Soviet Jews decide to move to Germany?" Unquote. Because they have no Jewish values. They're completely assimilated. They have no Jewish values. Most of them are intermarried, the ones that moved to Germany. Most of them are intermarried. They hardly think of themselves as Jews. They certainly don't believe in Judaism. And so Germany offered them. Germany very much wants to give the world the impression that they're allowing Jews in again, even though Germany is trying to destroy Israel. They're doing everything they can to destroy Israel and help the Arabs and trying to get Israel to commit national suicide. But they want to give the world the impression that, you see, we're allowing a Jewish community to live here again. You see, we're not Nazis anymore. And the Soviet Jews who went there, or like all the Jews who go there, have no principles and no morals and no Jewish identity and no Jewish values. If they do have any, then they're just hypocrites and phonies and frauds. And so they moved to the country that gave us Auschwitz and gave us Auschwitz and Treblinka and the Holocaust. And they don't care about it. Doesn't bother them. Those are the type of people that moved to Germany. And There are people like that that came from the Soviet Union. There are people like that that come from every Jewish community. Just as you have good Jews from every community, and you have bad Jews from every community. You have wonderful Soviet Jews, saintly, wonderful, magnificent Soviet Jews in Judea and Samaria, and who are in our Hebrew movement, and who are the finest Jews in Israel. And then you also have other Soviet Jews like this who are scum, who go to a place like Nazi Germany. So that's, you know, everybody, people have free will and people can choose good or evil. Thank you, Russian Leo. And we go now to the great spiraling leopard, the great Robert, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, please curse the corrupt police detective Saima Hussein. May this sharmuta rot in hell. Okay, unquote. Absolutely. May the name and the memory of this beast be obliterated, and may the name of the wicked rot. Absolutely. The British hiring this Muslim animal with a name like Hussein to be a police detective. What a joke. What a disgrace. What a farce. May she have every disease under the sun. May she be afflicted with every disease. May God afflict her with every disease under the sun. And may that just be the beginning of her torment. In this world, in the next world, may she have eternal torment. Yimach shma v'zichra. Thank you, Robert. And by the way, may all the good Jews and righteous Gentiles be protected from this evil beast. May God protect them from what this evil beast wants to do. And now we go to the great Maimonides, who writes, and I quote, Shalom Chaim, should Israel openly admit it has nuclear weapons, or should it continue to neither admit nor deny it has them, unquote. I think Israel should continue the current policy of neither admitting nor denying officially that it has nuclear weapons. Everybody knows that they have nuclear weapons. But I think that it's better for Israel psychologically to neither admit nor deny it. Once Israel would publicly admit it, can you imagine the headlines? And then they say, oh, and what's wrong with Iran? And what's wrong with these other countries getting it then? If Israel has it, they'd start a whole new thing. The media would make a whole big deal about it again, even though we already know they have it. But you know that they would turn this into another big deal. I think Israel should just continue. That is the one thing that they should continue to do. They should continue to neither admit nor deny that they have them. That would be our policy as well if we were in power. Thank you, Maimonides, and I want to thank everybody for another program that we very much enjoy doing. Until next week, Shalom.